Well, good morning, everybody. It is February the 9th, all day long. You know, I always wondered why they spelled February wrong. Why'd they put the R in front of the U? That's just the way my mind works. But they really didn't. This is the kind of thing that I have to look up, so I'm going to pass it on to you. You know, all of this comes from Rome, apparently. The Roman calendar at somewhere around 700 BC only had 10 months in it because the Romans didn't separate winter out. I can understand that. But sometime around 700 BC, the second king of Rome, Numa Pompilius, changed that. He added January and February to the end, yes, the end of the calendar, in order to conform to how long it actually takes the Earth to go around the sun. They had that figured out. The two new months were both originally 28 days long. So they got that fixed sometime, I think, 153 B.C. Before we adopted the Latin name for our second month, Old English used much more vibrant names to describe the month known as February. The most common Old English name is Salmanoth. January, Salmanoth, March. I think that sounds good. January is named after a Roman god, so February is actually named after a Roman festival called Februa, and that was when people were ritually washed. I guess now we don't need that because we get up in the morning and we just wash, right? We take a shower, bath, whatever. We don't wait for somebody to celebrate that. So that's just the way it is. Thought you might want to know that since my mind chose to delve into it. I apologize. We'll get on cars here in just a second. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the law. No, I'm not a lawyer, even though my name is Lawson. I do have a lot of lawyers in my family, and I still like them. There are things that people need to know, and especially when they're younger, so that they do not get messed up as they go through their lives. One such person is one of my service advisors. He asked me this morning, he said, Lenny, how do you sue somebody? And if they get a big judgment against you, like if they say you owe somebody $2 million, how do you pay that? Well, you know, I hope I never have to find that out, but you know, people can sue you for anything, and, you know, if they want to take you to court over an issue, all they have to do is go get a lawyer, or they can file a lawsuit without a lawyer, and you can appear before the Sessions judge, and he can make a decision based on your dispute. I had a guy one time, good customer of ours. He had a 1987 Chevrolet Monte Carlo. One day he decided to back out of the parking place. He'd gone in to get some parts, and he was backing out of the parking place, and he went way too far, went down the hill beyond where anybody would normally go, and he backed right into one of our light poles. He sued me. He sued me for the value of his car, not just the damages, but the value of his car, because he thought that my light pole was responsible for reaching out and striking his Monte Carlo. And so he prepared his lawsuit, and I called my lawyer, and we met at Sessions Court when the trial date came up, and he presented his evidence, and the judge just kind of looked at him and giggled a little bit, and he looked at my lawyer, what do you have to say for the defense? And he said, well, you know, sir, basically, is it not his responsibility to look out for light poles? You know, the light pole's been there. At the time, we'd been at that dealership for, you know, 25 years or so, and he'd been in there multiple times. And obviously, he just wasn't using his rearview mirror or being careful backing out. But he sued me. He lost. But that's beside the point, you know. I had to go down there and defend myself over a very frivolous thing that was somebody else's fault. Now, in today's time, people do not want to assume responsibility for their own actions. You know, I had a lady fall a couple weeks ago in the building at my other lot. We call it G2, Gateway Number 2, but it's a little used car lot. And I have a pretty big building there where we do all of our restorations and stuff. Well, she decided to go to the ladies' room, and then when she was coming out, She tripped and fell. You know, I understand that she tripped and fell in my building. She tripped on her own feet. She could have tripped out on the street or, you know, in her own yard. You know, I'm sure if she tripped in her own yard and fell, she wouldn't have sued herself. But she didn't sue me, but her boyfriend threatened to if I didn't do something. I said, well, does she have health insurance? Yes. Did she go to the hospital? Yes. Did they accept her health insurance? Yes. I said, well, what do you want me to do? He says, well, I mean, she fell in your building. And, well, I think you owe us something. Well, what do I owe you? I mean, I'm sorry it happened. Maybe you guys disagree with me. I don't know. I'm not trying to be mean or anything like that. But you know, if I'm coming out of a restaurant in Johnson City and I trip and fall, I'm not going to blame the restaurant. It's not their fault I'm clumsy. Now, if there's some kind of hazard there, you know, like a, I don't know, some kind of a rubber mat that's all turned up or something, and it's a hazard, I get that. I can get some liability. But when you're just walking across a flat floor and you trip and fall, it's probably not the business's fault. But there's a certain percentage of people that will sue your pants off, you know, just because of that, because they see an opportunity. I'm not that kind of person. You're probably not either. But we all know people that are like that. Or we've seen people do that kind of thing. I personally believe that people bear personal responsibility for crazy, I don't want to use the S word, things that they do, or ignorant things that they do. Ignorance, to me, is just the lack of knowledge. You know, acting without all the facts, not knowing the facts doesn't mean you're the S word. It just means that you are not aware. You know, you don't understand. I was talking to this this service advisor, and we were talking about these lawsuits. I was sued one time, big time. It was a situation where we sold a demo. The demo had 6,900 miles on it. I think it was a 1986 Monte Carlo. That was early in my career. I started at the dealership in 1978. By 86, I was pretty much running things with my dad. I was in charge of all sales and service, and he was the dealer, and he was my only boss. And sometimes that works great, and sometimes it doesn't. In our case, it did. He let me do pretty much what I wanted to do, and as long as it was in the best interest of the company. So anyway, we had this demo that we sold. Now, this demo had been driven by one of my salespeople, and he had driven it into a ditch. He missed a... It was a real foggy day, and he had driven basically through the intersection, past the stoplight, and straight ahead. It was like a T intersection. He went straight ahead and into a ditch. What it did was kicked up the bumper, damaged the front fascia, damaged the bumper itself. We had to replace the bumper and the edge of the hood. So we replaced the hood, replaced all the fascia, and fixed the car. A period of time passes, and we have a prospect on this particular car. It's out there on the lot being sold as a demo, basically a used car. I'm sitting in my office and I get a knock on the door. He opens up and it's my sales manager. And I said, we have a customer that's buying the 86 Z28 Camaro. And I said, do they know that it was damaged? He said, yes, the salesperson told me that they know it's damaged. If I could go back in time and go out and talk to that customer at that point and also get something signed, I would. But I was a little naive, I guess, and accepting and trusting, and so we sold the customer the car. Several months later, they came in and said, this car's been wrecked. We don't want it. Now, I pulled the folder, looked at the facts, customer signed for it, brought the sales manager in, and the salesperson, did you tell this person that the car had been damaged? And they said yes. So I believed them. My mistake. I could have probably traded with that gentleman or bought that car back, and it would have cost me maybe $2,500. He sued me. We went to court. It was a case of rescission. He wanted to rescind the contract. At that point, it was going to cost me to reimburse him for his payments about $13,700. I chose not to, and because I trusted my people, big mistake. So this was a jury trial, And the jury came back and found us negligent, basically, that we committed fraud, that we sold the car to a guy, did not tell him. So he won. And then the foreman said, sir, are we allowed to put on punitive damages? Well, I'm sitting there in the courtroom, and I'm thinking, what? And they slapped on, in addition to the $13,000, they slapped on $20,000 in punitive damages. Now, I wasn't involved in that transaction, but I'm the guy, my dad and I are the ones that have to pay for it. And, you know, I should have settled with the guy from the very beginning. So it ended up costing us $33,000. Now, we got the car back, which we ended up selling. I don't remember how much we sold it for. But we appealed that case because I thought it was wrong that, I mean, I agreed that, you know, we should have given the guy's money back, $13,000, that's fine. But I didn't agree with the punitive damages because it wasn't in case law, is not allowed in Tennessee law. Well, we appealed it, and we won on appeal, and then he appealed to the Supreme Court, and the appeal court was overruled and said that you can impose penalties, punitive damages, on a right of rescission case. And so we had to pay the full amount. Now, that is a part that actually changed the law. Before that particular case in the state of Tennessee, you could not get punitive damages on a rescission case. Rescission is, I want out and I want all my money back, which should be enough. But they thought that we were so fraudulent in that case. And I hate to admit it, but folks, this is the kind of stuff that I try to do on this radio show, just lay it all out there. And, you know, I could have solved that for probably $2,500, and it cost $33,000. And, I mean, back in 1980, when was that? I can't remember when the lawsuit was, probably 88, I think. $33,000 was a lot more money than it is now, still a lot of money. And so I vowed at that point, I sat down with my dad, and I said, Dad, I am never going to go to court again. I'm knocking on wood right now. I am going to figure something out. That was the most stressful, up to that point in my life, whatever age I was, that was the most stressful thing that I have ever been through. And so, you know, it's always better to sit down with the people and just find out what they have to say. You know, I know. I think I mentioned yesterday, some dealers, if you mention the word lawyer, they'll just shut you down and kick you out of the office. I don't. I mean, I want to hear how they're feeling and try to come to some kind of resolution. It's always better to resolve it in an office than it is in a courtroom. And so, anyway, that's something that I explained to my service advisor. You know, you get a customer that comes into the dealership and they're unhappy. They've been back, you know, two times, three times for the same problem. You know, it's really time to escalate this, probably past time, to get the people inside. Let's sit down. Let's talk about what we are doing. Make sure the customer understands that we are on their side. We're not on the side of the factory. We want the factory to pay for it. Or if we have messed up in some way, done an inadequate repair, you know, a poor diagnosis, or we just, you know, dropped the ball, you know, forgot about a car or something. There's a lot of cars on this lot. And, you know, if service advisors and service managers and all the people involved don't stay very organized, it's easy to let something slide through the cracks. And then what does that do? That leads to a dissatisfied customer. You know, the greatest cost of that to me is they just don't come back. You know, they just, you know, they decide to start buying all their future cars from somebody else. Think about what a costly mistake that is. Is to blow somebody out, you know, because you didn't give them the floor mats that they thought they were supposed to get, or you know, you didn't test drive their car after you repaired it, just to make sure that it was fixed. I mean, these are the things that frustrate the heck out of consumers, and you know, when it gets to me, or to you know, my service manager or sales manager, somebody has dropped the ball. And I don't care if the customer is wrong. It's on our part to communicate to them and give them the facts as we see it, and to come up with some type of a win-win solution instead of losing the relationship permanently. Because I've always felt that you know, a customer, the true test of a business is what do they do when things don't go right. It's real easy to be happy and nice and everything when things are going well, and you're selling the car and shaking hands, everybody's all excited. But when things go south, how do the people react? I talked to too many customers that say, you know, the service advisor was a real smart aleck, or, you know, I talked to the general manager and he was real snooty or something like that. I mean, why are people that way? I don't really understand it. It makes no sense to me, except for the fact that they're not seeing the big picture. And that's why it's so important for you to escalate your problem early. And be nice, you know, talk to the service advisor. If you're not getting the answers from him, then talk to the service manager. If you're not getting the answers from them, then go to the general manager or the dealer. Unfortunately, a lot of dealerships are run by big corporations, and they have some guy from Iowa. Not that there's anything wrong with Iowa, but, you know, some guy that's not from here that, you know, he's in there to get the numbers. And when he has to accommodate a customer, give them money back or something like that, that's going the opposite direction, and they're very resistant to do that. It's always better, I think, when you talk to the actual owner of the business. Like Johnson City Honda, for example, you can walk in and talk to the owner. Champion Chevrolet, you can walk in and talk to the owner. AutoNation, you can't. You know, the owner is nowhere present. The owner is a stockholder. And one of millions of stockholders. And I think there's advantages to doing business with people who still have the owners in the store, and they make their living there every day. So that was a long first segment. I'll take my first break and be back here in just a minute. Okay, I'm back. I'm getting ready to go out and speak to some high schools. And there are two basic things I want to talk to these high school students about, primarily seniors getting ready to graduate, maybe some juniors as well. I'm not sure exactly how the schools want to do it differently, but I go to the county schools in Greene County and then to the city schools if they want me. What do they need to know? As far from a financial responsibility standpoint, I think it's very important to give them the basics about making wise decisions. And to not overcomplicate it or oversimplify it, because, you know, financial responsibility is something that I think that if they don't get it from their parents, they're not going to get it, because teachers don't have time to do that. I may be wrong, but there are some classes, I'm sure, in schools that teach financial responsibility and understanding how the banking system works. Not in tremendous detail, but, you know, understanding your personal responsibility and how you manage money, how you manage credit, what you should do when you go buy a car, because that's where a lot of people get messed up. You know, one of their first ambitions is to get a new car, right? And so they go in and they don't know what to look for. They sign everything that's put in front of their face. They don't read anything. And then they get in trouble and they don't know what they bought. And there's a lot of dealers that prey on that. I could give you names, but I won't. And then what should they know as far as driving? You know, if you were giving a teenager tips on driving, let's say that they're your grandchild. If you were to make a list of the most important things that you would like them to know. Now, when I say know, I mean not just know, but understand and then adopt. Because a lot of people hear things and don't put them into practice. But as far as, I don't know how popular driver's ed is. My brother used to send his kids, he sent all of them. He had four, and he sent them all to what they called driver education at Road Atlanta, where they actually put them on skid pads and show them what a car's like when it's on ice and how to turn into a spin and how to correct yourself if you go off the edge of a road and you want to get it back onto the road. What do you do? You know, those types of circumstances. Kids need to know these things, and it's our responsibility to teach them. If they're not taking driver's ed class, then where are they going to get it? Now, you know, a lot of parents will be responsible and take their kids out, and maybe when it snows in a parking lot, they'll go out and show them some tips about how to control a spin and what does a car feel like when it's spinning sideways. You know, how do you control that? But there's a lot of kids, I'd say the vast majority, don't get any of that. They just get a driver's license. And then they get some junker car that you know, doesn't have any safety features on it, and the brakes are probably half worn out, and the parents don't have the money or the time to be able to address that. Where are they going to get that? You know, and I just feel like that's a good thing for me to do. Of course, if not taking driver's ed, practice is so important. Like I say, taking some type of a course or getting some experience. How do you teach them how to avoid distractions? You know, things like tailgating and the what can happen when you get too close to the car in front of you. Road rage, how to deal with that, how to avoid road rage. Things that, you know, driving is not a competition, but seems like too many people turn it into a competition. Understanding, you know, blind spots and how to set your mirrors. You know, I've taught a lot of people how to set their mirrors. They said, well, you just set the mirrors where you can see, right? See the side of your car and see the car that's coming. I said, no. If you can see the side of your car, your mirrors are adjusted improperly. You know, you should, well, I won't get into that right now, but I'll talk about that tomorrow. You know, understanding signs, using your blinkers. How many people turn off and don't use their turn signals? What does driving defensively actually mean? What are you doing? You know, you're paying attention to that other guy more than you are to yourself. Making sure that you just put the phone down. You know, the phone is such a distraction, and kids are so addicted to their phones. How do you control that? I wish there was something that we could put in our cars that would disable the phone as soon as you get into the car. That would be good for all of us, wouldn't it? Okay, I'm going to take my last break. I'll be back here in just a second. You know, my kids wanted to be a taxi service for their friends, and I had to remind them, no, you are not a taxi service. You are not to give other kids rides until you get to a certain age. I mean, that's the law. That's the Tennessee law. But that's my law. I mean, I'm giving you a car. Well, I'm old enough to make my own. No, you're not. You know, as long as I'm paying the bills, providing the car, and paying for the cell phone, I'm in charge. You will do what I say. And when I find out you're not doing what I say, then we'll park that car, and I'll have that phone, and we'll be done with that. I mean, that's just the way it has to be. I mean, driving is a privilege, isn't it? Getting a car and having that kind of freedom, it's a privilege, and it can be abused if we're not careful. If you want to track your kids, there's all kinds of things. You can just go to Amazon. I was looking it up where there's devices that you can put on the kids' cars to track them. It's not against the law. You can do whatever the heck you want to. You're the parent. Here's a 4G GPS tracker. No hidden fees. It'll track the car. It'll give you driving dynamics. Where did they go? How fast did they drive? That kind of stuff. It's $139. You just mount it in the car, and then you can monitor everything that they do. I don't think that's a bad idea. Well, folks, thank you for listening to this edition of My Car Guru. Hopefully there's something here that can benefit you or your family, and we'll be seeing you tomorrow.